back and tell us
when
you were born. And
yeah,
stuff.
Well, I was born in 1908. 1922 when I left school, and conditions then were worse than they are now, immediately after the First World War. So there wasn't work about at all. No such thing as doll at 14 years of age. And because I was a Boy Scout, of which I am proud, obviously, the Scoutmaster, who was a Reverend, Walter Strange, he got me a job at the Wolseley in the machine tool drawing office with a view to 7-year apprenticeship then. But after about, that was on November the 5th, when I started, and that's when the sparks started to fly. That job lasted about 18 months when Morris Motors took over Wolseley Motors and everybody was pushed out. And at that time, a lot of the senior men from the Wolseley joined the Rover Company, including Ernest Davenport, was the well-known superintendent those days. I didn't start in any capacity at all, only a driller, a drilling machine operator. And that was December 1925 when I started. We never had a regular job. We were in and out. It was a very seasonal job those days, and if you worked for 3 months, it was a luxury. So much so that each weekend we would be looking over our shoulders to see if we were going to be sent out to come in next Thursday or not at all next week. Because those days, the factories were, well, we only had the one factory at Tyseley then. And they were run by what they call senior tool setters, senior setters. They were not tool setters in the true sense of the word, whilst they had to do some of it, but they were charge hands, come foremen, come the lot. And their wages, their livelihood, depended upon the output of the particular sections they governed. So it was reasonable to think that if they could only see so much work next week, they'd only want so many operators in to do it so that they would maintain their level of bonus and wages, you see. That went on for quite a few years. And I don't know whether I'm right, 1929, I think it was, when we really had this upset with the receivers in, well, the bank came in, and Hal Graham, a banker from Sheffield, came down hurriedly with a bank full of money to pay us on this particular Friday. And strangely enough, there was a lot of work about. But there were a lot of cars lining up in the, what was that car we did? It was a fabric body thing.
12 horse.
12 horse that we were making for Australian export, those days. And suddenly it stopped. And the factory was full of these brown coloured vehicles, fabric body. And I think I'm right in saying they sold them for about £90 a piece to workers.
Baldwin was the charge, yeah.
That's right. I wasn't old enough to take advantage of these sort of things. I was still just a machine operator. And the bank then eventually brought in Charles Bedeau, who was a French engineer, who had the first thought on stopwatches and time and motion study. And he came in with all his Bedeau engineers, they were called, and one amongst them was a man named A.J. Worcester.
Oh,
and he worked for Charles Bedeau, and he showed a bit of enterprise, a little bit above anyone else, and this Bedeau system was such a fabulous thing for the workers. We got twice and three times the amount we'd ever had with the Rover. But we didn't realise we were being used, you know. We did a lot of work, a terrific amount of work. It wouldn't be tolerated today. It wasn't tolerated at Coventry factory. We got a Coventry factory then, and it wasn't tolerated there, so the railway then had the power to pick up all the machine tools and bring them to Tyresley, and left these people at Coventry saying no, and I lost the job. And that's when we started to take on the major components, like the cylinder blocks and the crankshafts and the conrods.
Mm.
Now, when they got this Beddow study fully installed and all the time studies available, we went to work one day and found all the gates shut.
Yes.
Nobody could go in. This amazed us. This was in early 32. And this amazed us. We got plenty of work. The shop's full of work. But now we just had our cards. And 2.5 days afterwards, I've been looking for my telegram this morning. You know, I've still got it somewhere.
Yeah.
I had a telegram from the Labour Exchange, report to the railway company immediately. And I went, and there was this self-same Frank Holland sitting in all his glory in a little wooden hut in the middle of the shop. Looked up at you and said, okay, start tomorrow, 10 1/8 per hour. Well, I'd been getting 1 11 an hour on Meadow. And I only went to hesitate. He said, take it or leave it, you know.
Sign new form, didn't we?
That's right. So if there's anybody says, including me, they've got a full service before 1932, they're not telling the truth.
That's right.
Mind you, it was only 2.5 days.
Yes.
But we all signed a new contract.
Correct.
And then we started, and we found this A.J. Worcester became our manager. And one of his understudies, Chris Payne, he came along as the time study engineer. They converted the Beddow timings into money, and it didn't half look sick then. But what could we do? We'd sold ourselves, really, and we'd committed ourselves for this fantastic money that we were getting, and then suddenly we found that we'd worked against ourselves, and it was on that occasion that a lot of people decided to leave.
Yeah. 9 pence an hour, I think I started at.
Mm.
And then it went
there
to
were some had to start at 6 pence an hour, 7 pence an hour, 9 pence farthing,
that's right,
10 3/8, and then the 11 pence 3 farthings was the top rate.
Yeah.
So what was the top rate?
11 pence 3 farthings, 46 shillings plus 10, okay, supplementary.
For what sort of people was that? For
skilled.
For the two-room men?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, no more, no more. Then we, the next rate was about 39 plus 10, and then the next one was 36 plus 10,
yeah.
That was the one we were with, wasn't it?
Right.
Anyhow, this went on, and we started on this, it would be the P1, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
With the freewheel. Which was something that
something new that was.
The French firm was doing. What's the French firm? However, we'll think about that.
Yes.
And this car went. We did a 10 horse and a 12 horse and a 16. 10. 12, 14 and 16,
that's
wasn't
right,
it?
That's good. Yeah.
And we did a 20 as well. But this was a very canny move on part of the... overriding this, by this time the Wilkes brothers had come in.
That's right.
Now, these were the men that if they could see things going like they are now, they'd be fantastic. These were the men who were not only magnificent managers, directors, they were engineers.
Right.
And at that time we all had to know our job. There was no such thing as inspection. If you wasn't capable of doing your own job, yeah, right, you were out. No ifs or buts about it. Didn't have a crowd of blokes following you around that you could say, well, it's his fault and his fault,
no,
it was your fault.
Yes.
You got paid for it.
Yes.
Now the Wilkes brothers, they were magnificent to us. They both came from the Humber, and we got improvements. We improved that much that there was 10,000 motor cars sold every year prior to the war. 10,000, which is 250 a week, which kept us all in work.
Yep.
In all the time, this is what progress was.
Yes.
We never lost another day. Never lost another day. We were magnificently looked after by marvellous bosses. We didn't get all the money in the world, but as we've previously said, that if we'd got to see it all over again, we'd do the same.
Yes, yes.
Just before the war, people began to take notice of us, so because we never sold abroad. Nobody knew who the Roma was. But somewhere along the lines, with these magnificent directors and management we got those days, we were recognised, and we landed an order to service the Cheetah engine, which was an Armstrong Siddeley rotary engine. And to this end, we had a new section built.
At Tisley?
Yes, which was over the blooming pigsties and what have you.
Yeah, anywhere
and,
really.
Yeah, and, it, and just as we were about to start on this job, the war broke out. So we didn't have this job as a service item. We immediately landed an 8,900 order for the Cheetah. And story goes, and I'm not, I'm just repeating this, the story goes that we made such a success of these Cheetah engines that they went into an Oxford training plane, didn't they?
That's right, they were all trainers. Yeah.
And the chaps that were out in them, they used to look at the plaque on the engine and say, "Ah, oh, that's the one I want to take out, that's the Rover."
Yeah.
Although the, Armstrong Siddeley had been making them for some years.
Yeah. Where did you stay your work in the 30s? Did you stay in the machine shop, or where were
yes,
you in the 30s?
Yes, I was then charge and come something on the crankshaft section. But immediately the war broke out, that was my first break. I was made a foreman while all these chappies here, quite a few we could mention, Stan was one of the leading ones, we had to disperse. We hadn't got a factory big enough now. And because it was wartime, they had to go and take some mills over in the Yorkshire area.
Yes, I've heard about
that. Well, Stanley will give you a complete history of the Yorkshire area.
Yes,
I only went up by part of my job.
Right, you
but
said
Stanley was there most of the time.
Oh, very interesting.
And we did these 8,900, and then we found ourselves with a contract for the Rolls-Royce Meteor engine. Making the Rover name bigger all the time, weren't we?
Yes.
This was when we were now recognised as being an engineering company. We were the Rolls-Royce, really, of the smaller companies. And
Did you do that work on the same machinery, basically?
Well, yes, but we did have to have some ministry machines in special purpose. Now, we did. Yeah, the general rough.
Yes.
First and second operation stuff, yeah. We were using machines when I left in 1973. We were using some that was used in the First World War there.
Yeah.
As a shadow, when it was also a government factory.
The First World War, no, it was the First World War, it was, what was it, components and munitions,
that's
wasn't
right,
it?
Yeah. They started with bicycles, actually, didn't we?
Components, musicians, and munitions, and it was 1919 we took it out.
Yes, that's when...
But I wasn't there then.
No.
However, by this time, I am growing in stature, not in size, but, you know. I worked on night shift during a long time during the war, when we were completely bombed all the way around. You couldn't get out of Tisley in the mornings.
No.
But that's by the by. And when the war finished, as I see it, we started to offload this Meteor engine into the Acox Green factory. That being a shadow factory during the war, and this was a shadow factory here, we're not far from the Solihull factory, you know, here, it's just above. And these two being shadow factories, we offloaded them quickly out of Tyresley so all these chaps could come back and help us to make bloody motor cars again, which was the most important job then, get back. But of course we dispersed all our jigs and tools and patterns all over the country, in rooming cellars and unknown places, and we had to use our expertise and the knowledge of the job to go and sort out what belonged to who, and because there was no records kept, they were just taken away. So it was then that we had to show our skills again by getting back onto the road with a motor car, with little or no tooling. Stanley used to stand and build engines on his own. You know, not just tighten a few nuts up.
No.
Build an engine on a trestle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he reviewed some of his men, of course. Sam Stan was a senior supervisor. And, but he had to do it like I had to do it.
Yep.
You couldn't stand at the end of a section those days. You weren't allowed to. You weren't expected to. You've got to be doing something.
Oh, right. So even though you were...
No matter who you were.
You were a foreman by then.
I was superintendent by this time, but it didn't matter. It didn't make any difference who you were. The higher up the scale you got, the less money you got.
Yes.
And you got to cater to the lavatory, you know.
That's right.
Yes.
Anyhow.
You were superintendent where?
Tyresley.
Yes, but for the machine, which section in Tyresley? Was there only one?
Oh, no. Well, I was in Tyresley 2 and 3, as we knew it, which was the major components and capstans. It was divided up into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 shops, but number 4's was the plating shops, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it's difficult to go because at one time, when they came back from Yorkshire, you remember, Walter Richards didn't want to come back.
Wally Richards, he came back.
Yeah, but he didn't want
he
to.
He didn't go.
So they put me on the job that he was going to have.
And he went back.
Then when he came back, I went in 5 and 6 shop on the gears, the gearboxes.
Albert Ashton was there then.
Yeah. But then Walter Richards didn't stay long. He went back to his lobs up in Yorkshire, didn't he? And then I went back onto the axle. And, but I was in the story at this stage. We found, or the management found, here again, I wasn't on this level, but an A.B. Smith was on the shadow factory groups. We found that we couldn't make motor cars because they wouldn't give us an allocation of steel for a private individual, you know, a luxury job, that's it.
Yes.
So once again the Wilkes brothers, they came forward and they thought about this funny little vehicle that they give us little drawings on woodbine packets and do you remember? We had a marker outer, a man marking out castings and stamping. And I did ask the other day if there's any such thing as a marker outer now. He isn't in the job description. Well, this chap used to mark out blocks, chalk it and scribe lines, centre dot, and we used to machine to these things. Yeah.
Huh.
And
was that because people couldn't read blueprints?
There wasn't any. There wasn't any blueprints when we started the Land Rover.
Right.
We were just told to do half a dozen of these funny little things. And we didn't know what we were doing.
What the hell is this?
And we found what we said, and I suppose it could be stood to be printed. All our buses by this time had got lovely farms in Scotland and Wales and so on. And we thought when we heard it was going to be a jeep, that we were making these so that all the buses could have a workhorse on their farms. And but it didn't turn out to be so. After we'd done 6, they said, right, do 50. Well, without jigs and tools, any stuff that we'd found and used, it was a very, very big job.
Mm.
But one by one, we did it.
Yes.
And then one day, they brought one of these horrible little monsters and plunked it in the middle of the machine shop for us all to see. And as we are plastered with the media today, with ET, this extra... This happened 40 years ago. They put this ugly little thing in the middle of our shop by the side of beautiful, gleaming, Rover, luxurious cars. Whatever's this? But like ET, it's something we began to love. We got to like it. And when we made the 50, they said, right, now we'll start tooling it up. And we got the drawing office people down, and they looked at the stuff we had used, temporary. They sometimes thought it was horrible, although it had done the job. They could improve on it. Some that they copied, yes, and bit by bit we tooled up. And this is how we went.
Oh, yes.
I can't go beyond. And then, although all the lads had come back then and we were all happy again, we used the steel, as I understood it, for the car.
Yeah.
And made the first Land Rovers with aluminium bodies.
Yes, yes, that was one of the reasons, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the demand for these things became so great that Stanley's big shop, where he did all the gearboxes, engines and axles, started to burst at the seams.
That's right.
So, they had to find somewhere else. And the factory space was very scarce then.
Yes.
Couldn't find it anywhere.
Yes.
And we, in our glory, took Berman's old factory on in Edgbaston, in the slums, Sun Street. It was a three-storey building on one side of the road.
Yes.
It was on the side of a hill, you see, so you went up three flights of stairs,
yes.
And then when you went off, you were at ground level over. And they sorted me out and said, you'd better go and have a look at Ryland Road and see what you think about it. Ryland Road, I didn't even know where it was.
Where it was, yes. How far was it from Tysley?
I suppose about 4 miles eventually, but if you think on Paul in those days,
yes,
4 miles was a long way, you know. To live here those days was a long way, unless you had a car.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
To get to Tysley from here, it was a bus. All the day getting there.
Yes.
With a car, of course, it's different. Anyway, I went up there and the factory was empty and it was filthy. And the oil was running down the drains, you know.
Yes.
Things that we weren't allowed to do. And when I saw it, I had a shock of my life. Is the tape on?
No, it doesn't matter. That's all right.
When I got there, it was lunchtime and the place was locked up. And I knew Tommy the Promiser was there, and Horace Whale, and I thought, oh, they'll be in the pub. So, luckily, I went to the first pub, and there they were. What have you come for? I've come to see the French pub. Cool, you'll have a shock. Anyway, we had a few drinks, and when I got back on the afternoon, I was on the section, and I was in the office, and Frank Holland came in. Well, what do you think about it? It was tough. I said, well, he said, never mind. Well, did you enjoy the bloody pub?
Yes.
So somebody had told him that
yes.
And I said, no, I didn't enjoy the pub, and I don't enjoy the bloody factory either. So he said, well, you've got it from now on, so you better pack your bags and go.
So what, you became this super...
Well, I'd be the manager then.
Yes, of the whole factory.
Of the whole factory. We weren't allowed to call ourselves managers those days. We were lucky to have senior superintendent status, weren't we?
Oh, yes.
Oh, Mr. Worcester wouldn't give you a title. You weren't allowed to have your name on the office door.
Oh, my God, no.
No? This is And you weren't allowed to put a bit of brown paper up at the office window either. And he had all his offices made that he could look in when he came up.
Oh, yes.
And this was how it was. Mm-hmm. We went to
Ryland Road,
and every night some machines came, every night. Frank Holland wouldn't let them stop the machines until 6 o'clock. He'd stand at the section. The electricians would be there with the ladder.
Yes.
To go up and pull the buzz bars out. On the skids, on the lorry. Ryland Road. I would have to be there to receive them, together with other people. No, I didn't do it.
No.
And we either had to haul machines up a hole in the roof, or down a hole in the floor to the various, yeah. And we couldn't go home, this was a written law, we couldn't go home until those machines were in, levelled up, checked for running the right way, and the first component off. And the operators would be on the bus the next morning, and instead of going to Tyson, they'd come to Ryland Road and start work on the machine they'd left the night before. They can't get this done now. If they go across the road, they want rehabilitation or something.
Yeah.
However,
what sort of machines were those which you brought over?
Yeah, well, we had some big bar or towers which were very heavy. They had to go on the ground floor.
Oh, yes.
We had a lot of capstans and drillers and milling machines.
Were they mostly, what sort of Herberts or? Yes, American or German or?
Oh, no, not at those days. No, very few German machines about. No, they were all Archdales, Herberts.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, no, no.
Churchills, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we had a lot of Churchill grinders, yeah.
Mm.
Well, all this type of machine was moved in, and we set about making, ball joint units, and
steering tiles.
And it wasn't big stuff, but we did in the one shop up the hill, we did take the cylinder heads.
Right.
And it became a very, very good unit. A very good unit.
How big did it become, Ryland Road? How many people do you remember?
Oh, about 400 people. When it was full. Yeah, might have done as well. Yes.
And all from Tyseley, or did you take...
Well, we had to, now, when we wanted new labour, we used to stand outside and shout up the entries, and down would come an ex-Burman chap. You know, Burmans, when they moved to Kings Norton, a lot of their very, very good men refused to go, you know, because they were used to getting out of the house straight over the road.
Oh, yes.
Living there, like.
And I know when I went in a foreman heat treatment man, I went in the pub, and they pointed the man out to me. I went in, Dougie. I give him a job practically in the pub, and he turned out to be a brilliant bloke. But he was one that wouldn't, and he was single, he wouldn't go to Kings Norton.
Huh?
So yes, we had quite a lot of Burman people. And
What factory is Burman?
Oh, they're the steering details. Yes. They are steering.
Oh, they used to do gearboxes as well.
Yeah.
Oh, so they were on similar.
They make the complete steering box.
That's right.
Burman.
Yes.
They do now for the train.
They do that, yeah.
Yes, they bring the whole. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there were people who used to do the same work, basically. They were skilled and in the job.
Very much so.
Oh, yes. Oh,
very
yes.
much so. And
that's good.
By the time this was going on, I only stayed there 2.5 years. And A.J. Worcester one day, and he used to come down and he used to pull some strokes on us. He was a brilliant manager.
Yes.
He used to make it absolutely clear to you that he's doing you a favour. We appreciate what you're doing for us, Tom. He said, now, on March, I'm going to put you on the monthly staff. And this was a big move. And my salary was £550 a year on the monthly staff. And then I realised why he'd done it. Whilst I was there, getting these machines every night, I was getting such a lot of overtime. Yeah. And he didn't want to pay me this overtime, so he come and flannel me. And
oh, yes, yes.
And this is how they made the profit. This is it. It was brilliant. And another day he came down and said, Tom, we're really tickled pink. Although he brought Captain Savage down. He had been with us then.
Yeah,
he'd been with us some time.
Good man he was.
And he said that, so pleased with what you've done with this horrible factory that...
Yes.
You'll notice in your pay packet next month. And I said, thank you very much. And when I got my pay packet, sure enough, it put an increase in, and it was £22 a year. And I've never known from that day to this what it was for, because it didn't make anything, it didn't level anything up. It just made it more hard. So this is the treatment we had, but we loved him for it.
Yes.
Nobody ever told him what to do with his job. Money might have told us, but
yes,
he was great.
So what sort of, sorry to interrupt, but what sort of direction did he give you for the output? Did he give you numbers you had to produce every month?
We were responsible for the output and the budgeting of science. And you weren't allowed to have a budget, so much so that if you wanted a stick of chalk, it was advisable to buy it on the way up to work.
Yeah.
And when you went to the stores for some emery cloth, they used to tear it off in strips.
Oh, yeah.
They wouldn't give you a sheet.
Everything.
Look, this is how Ralph made the
coffee. You got a paintbrush was a problem.
Oh, yeah. You had to wait in a queue for that. But basically, things were looking up now.
Yes.
And Stan's area was stretched to the bloody limit still.
Yes.
And he got me to go back to Tyseley as assistant production manager to Frank Holland, you see.
Oh, yes.
Because Frank Holland was getting towards, well towards his time.
Yeah.
I'm talking about 1952 and a half,
yeah.
In May.
Oh,
52.
Yes. Yes.
May 52, I went back to Tyseley as Frank Holland's assistant, which he wasn't very pleased about, because he never wanted any help. Frank didn't. We were the best of pals.
He didn't want those.
But he used to send me on the most diabolical errands to get rid of me.
Yeah.
By which time we opened Perry Bar. I should say that was about 1953 or 54.
Yes.
So down to Perry Bar I went, and I was told to stay down there until I got X number of units out. And I stayed there for quite a few months. And
was that equally difficult or not so difficult as well?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. Might be difficult to some people,
but you were used to it, of course, a bit.
Well,
you had some
general approach, and yes, they couldn't pull our legs.
Yes,
as regards doing the job, because Nicholas always used to say, "It's no good pulling the gardener's leg. He'll come and show you how to do it if you're not careful."
Yeah, that was the time, wasn't it?
He always said that. But if you put somebody in a bit green, they would soon play on it, those shop stewards, but that's regardless. And then I came back from Perry Bar, and I'm still under Frank Holland's feet, and they decided then to move the gearbox out to make way for Stan to make his magnificent tracks that were then. And once again, Frank Holland said, when you've drunk your cup of tea, come with me. So down to Percy Road, great. And there on the, over the building, it got Wright, Bindley and Gill. And we go in and it's an empty shell, great holes, timber all over the place. Oh, what a shocking mess. And, I've run the story a bit. AJ Worcester sent for me one day and said, "Are you going?" I said, "All right." And he said, "We're going to open a gearbox factory, and we want a man with your expertise and handling of labour. That's the thing we want. Would you consider taking this job at Percy Road?" And I said, "Well, that's bloody funny. I thought I was Frank Collins' assistant." He said, You think about it, I'd like you to take it. Well, nobody knew about this factory. And he said, well, by the way, Tom, don't tell Frank Holland I've spoken to you about it. So I said, okay. So Frank Holland takes me down. We come out, and he looked at the door and at the big notice, and he said, that ought to be right, Brindley and Gill, hadn't it? And so I said, I don't know. And he said, well, what do you think about it? What do you think about what? He said, how would you like to be manager here? I said, it depends. If the manager here gets more money than the assistant production manager at times. And he said, I expected that bloody answer from your mercenary bugger. We did. In the middle of the road, he said, about me verbally. But we were great pals. So I said, well, you know, I ain't going to work open factories all the time like this. Just to get no further.
Yeah.
So he goes back to AJ Worcester. He said, I spoke to Tommy Brindley about that job, and he ain't keen on it, you know. And AJ used to wear his trilby on the back of his head all the time.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I can't understand that. He was all right when I spoke to him about it. Frank Holland, he didn't forgive me for that for a long time. And I said, well, what would you do, Mr. Holland? He told me not to say anything to you.
Yes.
And they said, taking me down there on a bloody fool's errand, you knew all about it. And
yes.
I don't want anything to do with it.
Yes.
Anyway, we didn't lose each other's confidence. We were all right. And I took that job. And it was in 1955. And then in 1959, November.
Yes.
By which time we'd got a new director, Joe Walton, who had been the director of the Shadow Factory, you say.
Oh, yes.
He sent for me and said, we'd like you to come back to Tyersley. Now, can I recap on that? Whilst I was at Percy Road, Frank Holland left, retired. We had a lot of parties on his behalf.
Hmm.
And that was my job then. I'd got the job on paper. But a chap named Ernie Scott come in. All right, Ernie Scott had worked with us up till 1939, but he had left. He was a chief draftsman.
Went to the Singer.
He went to the Singer.
Oh, yes.
And he'd come back. And me being domiciled at Percy Road,
yes.
I gave Frank Holland's job to Ernie Scott, which didn't go down very well with me. And when I talked to Ernie Scott about it eventually, he said, Tom, if I'd have known that memo existed, because I've still got the memo now, you see. He said, I wouldn't have taken this job, and I said, I'll forget it, I'm all right. If it's only something to say, I think I haven't ought to be. Let it stand.
No.
I've been to every bloody factory. And Tyersley's the place I started at. So, we were within months. Joe Walton and Ernie Scott sent for me.
Yes.
And they offered me the job at Tyersley. Ernie Scott was moving up.
So what did you become then? Production manager?
Yeah, well, manager. We weren't allowed. I was a manager, yes, factory manager.
But you still couldn't call yourself. Oh, you could call yourself.
Well, yes. AJ had moved on then.
Had he become by then?
Well, he went as a director to Solly Hall, but he didn't go down very well. Unfortunately, the lads up here weren't used to his manner of managing. We were.
Oh yes.
But eventually he retired. So then people started to get tags and...
That's when that started.
What was I then? I was area manager. Manager when I left, I think I was. Yeah. So the last 14 years...
Yes.
I spent very happily at Tyersley. With a general responsibility
You were over assembly and everything.
Stan's area was a very rare, and AJ Worcester, in his wisdom,
yeah.
wouldn't let people like me manage Stan. No. Because what he, it was Frank Holland's brusque way of management.
Yes.
He always said, I did, I couldn't afford to let Frank Holland have the assembly because he'd browbeat them into building stuff that that's wasn't right.
Right.
But of course that was...
We were responsible for it.
So,
oh, straight, yes.
So it was not until the new directors come that I had the job and they gave me the overall. I was the first man ever to take control of the assembly, the tool rooms, the plant.
That's the lot, over the lot.
And I was in charge of all the lot, even the plants at the other factories, you know.
Oh yes, include all the E&T factories. Yeah, that's fine.
But there's about 10 people doing those jobs now.
Yes, that's something I'd like to talk about.
The overmanning, yeah. So,
so you stayed till the retirement?
In 1973.
Yes.
Shall I tell him the rest?
You're pretty well
done.
That's it.
Yeah. In the April, I booked a cruise and I was retiring in the July. And around about the April time, there was people leaving left, right and centre. Not redundant. Nobody at the Rover wanted redundancy. Everybody wanted to work on after a 65.
This was a bad thing, really.
And redundancy wasn't thought of.
No.
And every day or every week I found that I was making presentations to people, sometimes twos and threes and ones. And the one Thursday morning I left here and Horace Bloomer, I'll never forget it, Horace Bloomer, a kid that started with me in 1920-something, he was retiring. He was at least a few months older than me. And I remember saying to him, Horace, this must be the happiest day of your life. I'm looking forward to it. And he said, well, I think so.
Yes.
And the secretary was tugging on the coat. You wanted in the office. And I said, we're going to wait. And I said, I'm busy. And Jack Lloyd, the policeman, he got an envelope with some money in that he was leaving. And he wanted me to present. He said, I want Mr. Brindley to present it, and I want my photograph taken with him. So I said, well, I've got to see Jack Lloyd next. And she said, you must come at once. So I saw Horace Bloomer off, apologised to Jack Lloyd, went to the office, Frank Hill was there, and Bill Bennett of the Precision Tool People, a rep, was in my office. And my first reaction to was, Bill Bennett, you could have waited. So Frank Hill said, come on, boss, you're coming with me. And I said, well, what's the matter? He said, never mind, come on with me. This was one of my superintendents. And my secretary said, I'm coming as well. So we got out of the factory, and I said, what's it all about? He said, no, don't get excited, we've got to go to Sunday Hall Police Station. So my secretary said, now listen, we're not so sure that the police think that Mrs. Brindley's met with an accident. There's no evidence in a purse other than there's a plain shoe repairing ticket. And I said, oh, that's right. So I get to the police station and they sort of sedate me, and then the police took me to the hospital. They wouldn't let Frank take me.
No,
the police had got to take me, and of course when I went and got to the hospital, and we sat about for about half an hour, but she died. She got killed on the pedestrian crossing, just the bottom of the road here. So you can imagine what happened then. My life was shattered for a short. The company said, well, you please yourself what you do. If you want to knock off, but if you want to go on till Christmas, come on in and do something. We'll give you some special duties, which I was very grateful for, and I did go back into the Range Rover gearbox area and because they'd already appointed somebody into my job, you know.
Yes.
And I came out on November 73 from 25, December
25. Yes.
So, covers the whole of my life, working life, and if I could see it again, I'd gladly do it under the conditions we'd worked.
Oh, yes.
The last few years were a little different. Is any questions now before I finish? Could I really stand now?
Well, I haven't got a lot to say after you.
Yes, but your own life was different.
Yeah,
if you think about what you exactly did, I'm sure it's very different.
Do you want another drink?
Mr. Goodwin.
Dan Goodwin. I was born in Wales, in Shotton. And my father had a bakery business, and we had our own business, and then we sold that, and he came to Harbin, he took a pub in Harbin, and I came over, not that I was very keen on pubs at that particular time, and I got a job at the bus depot in Birmingham on the buses, you know, but I was in the shop on engines. I was like an apprentice there, you know, to a chap named Gott. And I was there for quite some time. And then
year was that?
I can't, years I...
This is after the First World War, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And then I went, they weren't getting a lot of money there, the regular job, and I went to the Austin, because they were earning more money. I was only young and I wanted more money. And I got a job at the Austin, I worked for a chap named Pickering on 20 Austin. And I was on water pumps, just an ordinary operator.
Yes, a fitter or not? An engine fitter?
No. Yes, just on water pumps, on engines, on the 20 horse. And then I was there for some time. And then they told me that they were earning very good money at the rubber.
Yes.
£6 out a week. And I thought I was only getting £3 out of it. Don't have a go. So I went and saw Mr. Simmons, Billy Simmons. He lived in Harbin. And he said, yes, you can have a job, son. I said, okay, Mr. Simmons. Now, will it last, this job? He said, son, it'll last forever. So I thought, right, I'll leave. Now, Mr. Pickton said, I think you're very silly, because we were going to push you forward, and you would have had a good job here, you see.
Yes.
Said, well, there's more money there, Pickton, so I think I'll go to the Rover. So I went to the Rover, and I just worked on ordinary...
Which year was that? Do you remember?
Oh, I wouldn't know. The years I can't remember so well, but I know I went to Rover.
Was that after the general strike?
Well, I've been there, the Rover, about 43 years. So it's going back then. And then I worked on these rocket shafts. And everybody was busy there, you know, and everybody getting this 12 horse out for these fabric bodies, you see. This is what we were working on.
Was that the Wayman bodies?
Yes, that's right, this fabric body.
That must have been around 27 then.
That Mr. Brindley talked about, that's right.
Yes.
Well, we haven't been in there very long, 8 weeks, so they come and they got no money to pay us. And there we are. So we had to wait outside while the man came and the banker and saw the engines on the floor, and then they dished the money out to us. And then...
The same day, was it?
Yes, all the same time as Mr. Brindley's talking about. Then we were out of work. And then, about a few weeks after, they sent for me back. You know, we started
the
up
The foreman
again.
Sent for you back.
That's right, we started up again, and back I went. And I worked on the line as an ordinary operator. And,
doing what work?
Oh, I was doing all sorts of jobs. I was supposed to be putting cranks in, and then I'd be putting cylinder heads on. If someone was out, and, you know, and come in, I would take the place, timing the engines, and, you know, so they, like, pushed me along a little bit.
Yes.
And,
thank
you, John. Yes, it pushed us along a bit, and then I,
Were you working in a gang, or not?
No, we didn't have gangs, no, we just had one line, you know, with engines going up, you know.
Oh, you pushed your own vehicles?
To start with, and then we had moving tracks, which come in later. And, I was only ordinary operator, and then when the war came on, I was working on the cheetah, as Mr. Brindley said.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
and I was on Cheetah on nights. And then they started this place at Earby, and they sent me up to Earby to take charge of this.
Is that in Yorkshire?
Yes, in this section there on the assembly, you see.
Yes.
And there was a lot of women working there, you know, they were all, a lot of women working, they'd never seen, they didn't even know what they were doing, you know, they hadn't got a clue. They're just ordinary women that had worked in the factories doing the cotton and one thing or another, you see. Anyway.
Were you a kind of super intelligent?
No, I was just an ordinary charge up then.
Charge. You went yes. with the same foreman, did you?
Pardon?
Did you go with your... With
No. I worked for a chap named Percy Wright.
Yes.
Who used to be at Tisley.
Yes.
With Mr. Brindley, and he took charge over at Earby.
Oh, yes.
So I was working under Percy Wright. Then we carried on then till the end of the war.
You moved up there, did you then?
Yes, and then they sent for us back. And they asked me if I'd take Jarjan's job on the assembly. And I said, yes, I would, but I'm too pleased to take it.
What section was that?
And on the assembly. And
not a certain section of the assembly?
Pardon?
Not a particular section?
No, there was only one assembly shop.
Oh?
Oh, yes.
So it wasn't a big assembly. How big was it?
Oh, it was quite a big shop, wasn't it, Tom?
Covered all the three major units and the engine test. Yes.
Oh yes, and a chap named Davenport, he was...
Yes, I've heard.
I worked for Davenport. But in the meantime, Mr. Holland had taken over the assembly shop, which AJ wasn't... He must have given it to him, I suppose, but he wasn't too keen about it, AJ. But anyway, he had taken it over. So I worked for Davenport then. Gradually we increased our output, as Mr. Brindley mentioned to you, and every engine counted. The quality was the thing that everybody was got to be very, very careful. Quality all the while.
Yes.
And we had no inspectors. No. Each man...
When did they come in, the inspectors?
Oh, they gradually came in later on, much later on, didn't
well,
they?
Well, it all, don't you think it all started, this inspection, during the war with the
yes.
AID?
Yes, they had.
That's the first time we noticed an abundance, and I'm afraid it grew from...
Gradually
grew. You know, from having a foreman inspector, they suddenly found they'd got a... manager inspector, like
that's right.
Stan Nixon.
That's right, he came.
So when things returned, he built an empire in
that's right, he built an empire, like he is. Yeah. But each operator was responsible for his...
Oh, for his own job.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. That's, you know. And any fault they had, they would say, look at that, that's no good, we can't build that, you see, and things like that. And then we would get old Mr. Brindley to come and have a look, and he'd say, oh, well, that's no good. We'd go back to the machine shop, and things were put right there, and gradually they came through. And
what, as a charge hand, what was your main work?
Well, anything, just going up and down and checking people and seeing they were doing the work right and things like that, and you know, all sorts of things like that. That they
did you got also replacements if people were ill?
I'll come to that in a minute. And in the meantime, we increased our output, and then we went on to the Land Rover. The Land Rover first was a 12 horse, started with
yes.
a 12 horse, and then they gradually increased the capacity of the engine and that. And in the meantime, like Mr. Brindley would come along and say to me, we want another 100 engines this week. He'd say, how many people do you want? I'd say, well, we want so many on the test, so many on so and so. And then we would tell Mr. Brindley, and he would say, right. He would get on to Harry Mason, who was personnel manager,
yes.
and he would get so many people in, and he would say, well, you better come and have a look at this fella,
yes.
if he's all right for you, and then we would start it. And this is how we went on. We didn't have people like they've got today, where you say, oh, I want another six people, you've got to go to London and say, well, you can't have them, or you can have them, and this is how we went
yes.
on.
Yes, now they try to get
but when we first started, I mean, if we was, as Mr. Brindley mentioned, if we were short of shellac, which we used to use shellac on the front covers for washers, and we hadn't got any, we would go, perhaps to Mr. Brindley and say, he said, well, go down the road and get some. and give us something out of the petty cash, and I'd go down and get some shellac. You know, and this is how we went on. And we had a chap named Bert Richards there, and he was over the consumable stores. But to try and get any rag or a paintbrush or anything to off him, it was terrible. Honestly, I mean, you just couldn't get it. And you'd have to say, well, I'll have to say, AJ, if you want any more of this. And we only wanted a piece of rag.
It's incredible, that, isn't it?
And you couldn't get a piece of rag even.
Yeah.
That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
You just couldn't get the rag. And this is how we gradually built up and built up and built up.
And everything revolved round money.
Yes.
Yes, I can say.
Profit. Profit. Well, all the time we've been talking, you know, we increased our profits to record levels every year.
Oh, yeah.
1932, by the way.
Yes.
Yes. And when we were taken over in 1967,
yeah.
I think the British Island,
yes, Rovers.
I think they paid us about $29 million for this place.
And then I was made foreman, and as Mr. Bindley pointed out, I used to work overtime at night when I was in charge, you see, and weekends would come in on Saturday, we'd come in on Sunday, and then when I was made foreman, when they said AJ sent for me, and he said, we're going to put you on the monthly staff. And I thought, my God, this is fantastic. And I thought, I went home and said to the wife, I'm on the monthly staff, lovely.
Yeah.
And I've got no money for a month. You imagine, I had no money.
Ah, yes. And a month in hand, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and I thought,
you don't have to live that first month, you know.
Oh, yes. Terrible it was. Terrible.
I had it, yeah.
Oh, and then I got my cheque and I thought, oh, yeah.
Yes.
Did that work good? I mean, I got a fair wage, you see, before, but all my overtime had gone.
Yeah.
I didn't get any overtime then. I just got my monthly money. I worked all night.
And if you complain, they say, well, I'm the staff, you have a privilege.
Yes.
You can go to the canteen and have a cup of tea.
That's right.
Put it down to the company. But they forgot to tell us the staff knocked off about 3:30. They were never there anyway. So you couldn't get a cup of tea. Yeah.
Oh, yes,
so,
yes.
So then, you know, Mr. Davenport left and AJ sent for me and I was made superintendent. And then I worked for Mr. Brindley. And
when was that? Do you remember that?
Oh, God, when was it? When did I? I can't, these dates I can't remember.
Well, you worked for me in 1959 and I came back.
That's right.
You've got a bit more story to tell, that, haven't you? When did you go to Acuff's Green?
Oh, after. A long
I know time. You did, but he went for a week, you know, to Acuff's Green.
Oh, yes.
I loaned him to him for a week to get on with the
V8.
I never saw him
again. And I never come back.
He never come back.
No.
So that was around 61, 62. Yeah, the V8 engine?
No, it was later than
that. Oh, no, the V8 is...
First of all, I worked for Mr. Brindley for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And he used to come up every morning to see what we...
Never missed.
Never missed. How many have you done?
Yes.
Until we were getting 1,200 engines a week, we were doing. Land Rover.
Land Rover only.
Under the wing. 1,200 engines a week.
Yeah.
And now they're doing 600 now.
With how many men did you do that 1,200 a
week? Half of what they're doing now, I can tell you that.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Well, you see, the biggest gap came between the individual piecework and measurement.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we all...
Now, maybe before we...
Yes, carry on.
Let's finish your story, because...
Well, then, you know, Mr. Brindley, every morning come up and say, how many have you done? So much, 1,200. Well, we want another 100 this week, and we would have to do 1,300. And this is... But the average output then was, I'd say, 1,000, 1,100. And we kept this up for month after month, year after year. Kept us up. And quality was the thing that we've got to watch all the while. Quality was the main thing of our engine. And then Mr. Scott sent for me and asked me if I'd go to Acuff's Green for a week. Because there was a problem over there with engines. So I went over the week and then I never came back again. I stopped there for 5 years. And then we started the V8 and got going over there and
till when was that?
Till I retired.
When was that?
Well, we're the same age, within a year, aren't
we? Yes, pretty well, yeah.
So you retired in 74?
72. Something like that, 72, yeah,
72. I retired in 73. You went in May.
That's right.
May 73.
That's on my birthday, that's right.
His birthday's on the 1st of May.
That's right, and I retired then. And this is how we've gone on.
I think so.
But Mr. Brindley has told you pretty well all the story in the early stages. I mean, I go over that, it's exactly the same as I just told you.
Yes.
You know, we started, and we had to start with nothing and go down and get anything from anywhere. We'd even go on the scrap heap and get stuff and make little jigs from down the scrap heap. Of course, then, Mr. Brindley, we've got a bit of stuff we can make a jig with to do something on the assembly. We hadn't got anything then, we just... this is how we started.
All right, then. Maybe we can discuss...
Because during these periods, Paul...
It's good now.
We scanners
were... When am I?
Upstairs.
Right, thank you.
I was also chairman of the Joint Production Council meeting that Nicholas has spoken to you about. Stan was on the committee as well. We had six representatives of the staff and six of the works, and they had the other men out, so they were chairman. I held that job for 15 years.
What was that? The
Joint Production Council Committee.
Yes. Yes. When did that start?
JPCA. Oh, it started, it started just after the war.
Didn't it start during the war?
No. Frank Holland was the first one, and he was up to Yorkshire during the war. I should say after the war.
Yes.
And he was the first chairman, and I followed him.
Yes. What did you discuss on those
programs? That's a bloody good question. And this was our reaction those days. What did we discuss? Dirty toilets, dirty windows, lack of labourers to sweep up, anything except production. You couldn't get a discussion going, or very, very, very rarely, with these lads in the shop. They would never commit themselves. But they would always come to me and say there was a toilet seat broken in number six shop or something like that, you know.
Yes.
But it was an unwritten law. We started at 1:30 on the afternoon, once a month. At 3:15, my secretary...